From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is being made in cities like Rochester across the country, where families are trying to figure out how to live in this uncertain time of the coronavirus. Low-income families are in a particularly vulnerable spot as the virus spreads. If schools close, where can kids get meals? What happens for families that are already deeply struggling outside of the school context? Our guests are going to explore what's already happening and what could come next. And I want to mention a few notes as the host of this program going forward because, boy, even in the last 24 hours, it feels like a lot's changed, right? A lot's going on. So I want listeners to know a few things. First of all, we've already started changing some of our policies with the show. You'll probably hear fewer in-studio guests as we go on. I will let our studio guests know. We really, really sort of nuke the studio after every conversation, and we're rigorous about that. But we understand that we may change policies or some guests may request not being in studio. We always prefer studio to phone in terms of audio quality, but this is not the priority right now. So we know our listeners will understand if that begins to change. We'll talk a lot about the ways the coronavirus is impacting our community and our world in the weeks and months to come. So there will be a lot on that, but it's not going to be all that. I mean, people need a break. We're going to have shows entirely designed to sort of be just mental junk food. We need that at times. You know, we'll do what sounds like a book club, music reviews, some goofy stuff, and then we'll do some thoughtful stuff, and then we'll do some hard stuff. We'll be here for all of it, and I want you to know that public radio is going to be a resource that will continue to be dependable, consistent, reliable, and we want to welcome your feedback about how we can do this well, how we can serve you as listeners. So you can always hit me up at edawson@wxxi.org, or you can email connections@wxxi.org. Because again, as I've been saying all week, and as I think as the best leaders across the country have been saying, preparation is not panic. Preparation is not panic. But we're going to continue to try to be prepared and be thoughtful. This hour, let's welcome our guests who are with us in studio. Pete Nabosny is here, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Julia Tedesco is President and CEO of Foodlink. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So, Pete, let me start with you because we initially had plans to talk to you about something else entirely. You're part of Reconnect Rochester, and we're going to be talking about some of those issues in the days to come. But we wanted to shift today because you and I think Julia are kind of uniquely positioned to look at what's happening and then ask how vulnerable families are being impacted. What stands out to you right now? What are the big questions for you?
Well, there's a lot of questions. I think there's a lot of uncertainty as to what's going to happen over the next, you know, days, weeks, months. You know, we're not sure how long we're going to be going through this. And there's, within that uncertainty, I think a lot of questions that people are raising appropriately in terms of how people will fulfill their basic needs over a course of time in which, you know, many people may be out of work. Mm-hmm. They may be told to stay at home. They may be quarantined. They may be ill. And they may lack some of the resources that they need to meet those basic needs in terms of things like food, which is, you know, one of those essentials. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people thinking about this. There's a lot of recommendations being made. There seems to be some progress happening in Washington, D.C. right now around, a package of both kind of stimulus and aid. But there's just a lot of uncertainty out there. It's time for a lot of people to be thinking about this and doing what they can at a local, at a state, at a federal level to give people more certainty as how this is going to proceed.
Julia, what stands out to you?
Yeah, all the things Pete mentioned, but of course, Foodlink has a laser-like focus on ensuring that people are fed at all times, but certainly during times of crisis. And we are most focused on those vulnerable populations, seniors during this period who are more likely to be isolated, children who it looks like now more than ever that we can expect them to be out of school for an extended period of time, and certainly low-income households across our region.
So, to some degree, there was a little bit of surprise among some parents that this morning the Monroe County Schools, you know, they held their news conference and they announced they're not closing schools just yet. They're canceling most of the activities associated with school, extracurriculars, kids going to plays, et cetera. But it does feel, Julia, that any moment that could change when you look across the country and as we get new information. Is that how it feels to you?
Yeah, we think we know it's a difficult decision to make. I don't envy the position of superintendents right now, because I think that they have the information in front of them that in terms of taking precaution, closing schools is a really good idea. But we have to consider the tens of thousands of students that would be out of school, potentially without supervision, but also without access to multiple meals per day.
Sure. And so let me ask, let's kind of work through the issues as I see them kind of one by one. So we heard the superintendent of Rochester Schools, Terry Dade, earlier this week telling WXXI's James Brown that the decision to close is more complex in districts that have higher poverty. And of course, we know Rochester has a lot. We're talking about a very, very high percentage on free and reduced lunch. A lot of kids need the district just to eat. What happens if the call came that starting Monday, RCSD was not going to hold in-person school anymore for a while? What does that process have to look like for kids who are vulnerable?
Yeah. Well, the good news is that there already is a USDA waiver in place that enables school food authorities like RCSD, who provide the national school and breakfast lunch programs, to continue service during sudden or emergency closings of schools. New York State applied for that waiver, and it was granted yesterday. That means that districts in our region will continue to be able to provide meals even when schools are closed. There is a second waiver in place that reduces barriers. So we obviously want to avoid communal feeding during a time like this. So we can do grab-and-go options now. There's also the opportunity to do satellite feeding. So it's going to require a lot of logistical changes for school food authorities in order to continue to provide meals, but they still have access to their same inventory of food, their same access to USDA commodities that help to sustain those meal programs. It's just a matter of reconfiguring how they're going to get the food to children.
And this is maybe even secondary at the moment, because primary has to be kids eating. I mean, people have to eat to live.
Yeah.
But for listeners who may be wondering, food delivery and prep, are we pretty confident that it's clean, it's safe? What are we thinking about there?
Yeah, we had a very good meeting with the individuals responsible for school food at the Rochester School District the other day. They are preparing for this. They actually have more of a capability for disinfecting in a sort of 360 manner than most organizations. I think the big question is they are planning, like everyone in town, for a reduced workforce and what that might mean. So as another organization that provides, right now we do between 3,000 and 5,000 meals every single day to school-age children in Rochester, we're facing the same challenges. We talked about combining efforts, combining resources, even if that means workforce or distribution capabilities, in order to ensure that kids are fed. Obviously, the district is working within different parameters than a nonprofit like Foodlink. So where they might face bureaucratic red tape, we are a nonprofit that maybe can navigate that a little bit easier. But our plan right now is to work around all of that. They have plans in place to continue to provide breakfast and lunch at select locations, and Foodlink has plans to provide meals outside of that, snacks, the third meal, the after-school meal that we tend to do for most kids in the city of Rochester, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention also emergency food packs for families. One issue is, of course, school food for kids, but the other is making sure that families are supplied and stocked with food during this uncertain time.
Listeners, if you've got questions or comments as we discuss these issues, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. It's 263-9994. Now, that's RCSD kids. You mentioned seniors. What would be your message for a population that is, by the day, a little more uneasy with even going out, even feeling like, can I safely have food delivered? You know, wondering about what's accessible, what will still be there no matter what happens, what they can feel safe about.
Well, first I'd address those low-income seniors, those that probably already are receiving food from emergency food pantries or agencies throughout our region. Foodlink is ramping up to not just continue our service, but to expand it. We are building food bundles that reduce the risk of any contamination or spread of COVID-19, and making sure that we have sites where we can distribute these safely and more food than normal to individuals, including seniors. I also understand that the county is being very proactive about this. They're working with Visiting Nurse Service and Meals on Wheels and other organizations. Congregate meal sites have been closed down for seniors. So they're working to pilot a home delivery system to make sure that seniors are still getting those meals.
Yeah, Pete, you know, it's this interesting sort of dichotomy of society right now. You've got people worried about whether they can get food, people who can't really afford food, people who rely on the food links of the world. And then you have people, and I'm not making light of this. I mean, I've been in this category myself where I go, well, if I have to go to Wegmans, should I go in the overnight hours? And I know, right, I think tonight they're shutting down to clean from midnight to 6 a.m. But it's like this, it's almost like a dichotomy of privilege in some ways. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is revealing a broader sort of binary that exists within American society writ large. You know, I think things like paid sick leave, that's something that a lot of people with good jobs and you know, middle class and upper middle class families, you know, they take it for granted that when you get sick or your child gets sick, you can take a day off of work. And that's good for your family. It's good for public health. It's something that is second nature to a lot of folks. But a lot of people in New York State, there is a proposal to extend sick leave across the state this year, but a lot of people in New York State don't get sick leave currently. People who work in service industries, a lot of folks who are, working kind of every day with a lot of uncertainty in terms of how much they're going to get paid and things like that. And they go to work because they have to feed their family. They have to pay their bills. And when they get sick, they're faced with really difficult choices of, you know, particularly in a time like this, going to work and so you can pay your rent. But then also balancing that against, you know, we have this kind of public health crisis that's going on. And so I think it's one real clear example of where this dichotomy that you reference exists. But then I think a lot of other folks like you and me are able to think through things like what's the best time to go to Wegmans,
right,
and
right.
And
how have
do
a
I,
car.
Yeah. How do I, you know, when I get there, what do I need? How much, you know, how many things can I store in my house? Do I have a second fridge? That all those things that a lot of people in our community are able to do, and it's good that they're preparing like that. But I think we do need to recognize that a lot of people don't have the financial resources to stock their house with 2 weeks worth of groceries at any time, and so that's where groups like Foodlink and others really have to be able to step forward to support a lot of people in our community, more people than I think folks realize.
Let me get our first phone call, and then we're going to kind of dive into some different policy ideas on what may be coming to help. Mark in Rochester first. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, good morning. I'm a pastor of a small, aging congregation. We average about 25 on a Sunday morning in attendance, and we need to decide if we should continue to hold worship services or not.
Oh. Well, look, I don't know that any of our three people in studio can give you a clear answer, but let me tell you what I'm reading from the experts, okay? So first of all, the answer is yes, you should probably suspend that because you've got an aging population, you've got people in close quarters, and if we're really going to be aggressive on the social distancing, that's a good idea. That's a smart idea. Frankly, some of the epidemiologists like Jeremy Conandike, who talked to NPR yesterday and has frankly been a must follow for everybody who wants to understand what's happening, has said we probably should have done that weeks ago. We didn't. And you know, so here we are. So the answer probably is yes. I wouldn't call that a panic move at all. I would call that prudent. That's up to you. As Dr. Mendoza said yesterday, Dr. Michael Mendoza, Monroe County Public Health Commissioner, did say yesterday, he doesn't feel like he can tell worship services to shut down. But I can. So I'm going to say, I think probably you should.
Calling for your advice.
Yeah. I honestly, Mark, I think the answer is probably yes. I think it's prudent. I think it's, but I think there's creative ways to stay connected. And I hope you can try to find ways to do that. I do know that it can be more challenging in different populations. But this is the challenge for all of us right now is going to be staying connected, but also staying prudent. This is, and next hour on this program, we're talking about the mental health challenge of that. It's not going to be easy. But if you just want my advice and understand I am not a doctor and I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm just a guy who reads a ton. Yeah,
probably so. Take it with a grain of salt and no panic allowed. That's where I would be.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you, as always, and good luck to you. We're all going to stay connected. I don't know. Does anyone in studio want to, like...
Yeah, I came in today, and I was thinking beforehand, I was like, I got to make sure I'm clear that, like, I'm not a public health expert. Yeah, I don't want to be giving public health advice. But at the same time, you know, I think everything, like you, I'm trying to read as much as I can on this, and you know, everyone's using the phrase abundance of caution constantly around this, and I think that's correct, right? We need to all think about all of our interactions, who we have connections to, who are, if we have, you know, neighbors or family members that have, you know, that are, you know, for whatever reason, you know, vulnerable population in terms of if this spreads to them, they're going to be, you know, in real trouble. And think through kind of all those precautions that we can take. You know, it is on all of us collectively to make these decisions and to prioritize public health and that public good where we can.
All right. So let me follow that up with answering an email. It says, Evan, I'm already reading that it's too late for containment. So why are we doing social distancing? That's a fair question. So let me again, knowing that I'm parroting a lot of reading here, let me explain. Too late for containment means the virus is probably spread a lot farther and wider than we already realize. We don't have a whole lot of testing going on, and we're starting to see more cases everywhere. And just because it has entered communities doesn't mean that we don't need to worry about social distancing. In fact, we need to worry about that even more, because what it means to say we probably can't contain it is that many people will get it in the next coming months. Many people. Maybe almost half of the country. We don't know. I mean, that's a possibility according to many, many epidemiologists who have been briefing Congress and writing to the public about this. You don't want that all in one burst. The health system would be overloaded, and we've seen that happen in places like Italy. We can handle this if we spread it out, if we are patient, if we handle symptoms smartly, and if we listen to the medical advice of the professionals. And what they want us to know is not everyone's going to get it. If you get it, there's a lot of different factors for how it'll impact you. You can probably, if you're not elderly or immunosuppressed, handle it at home for a while at least. And no one's saying don't go to the hospital, but there's a lot you can do. And quarantining and isolating is very, very important, because if we can at least slow it down, they call it bending the curve, we can make sure our medical system doesn't get overloaded at any one time. And that means the people who do need a ventilator can get one. That means the people who do need that ICU care can get it. That's the goal here. And we're all in this together. We're going to do this together. So that's why, you know, look. Mark, I appreciate you calling a talk show host and asking me for my advice on this. I wouldn't just take it from me, though. I would take it from the Kona Dykes, and I would take it from Anthony Fauci, who basically says, doesn't matter if you get zero cases in your community. Act like you have a lot and act like that now. So let's do this together, and then we'll see how long it takes to kind of work through it and get to the other side of it. But we will get to the other side of it at some point here. Now, back to the question of policy. Pete Nabosny has had many conversations on this program about the universal basic income. And let's get serious right now. This is changing, I would think, the public calculus about what a universal basic income is and when it is needed. So I think most listeners actually probably do know what that means, but why don't you explain what UBI is and now how you think it fits the context?
Sure. So UBI, universal basic income, is this idea that's I think grown in prominence over the last couple of years. A few years ago, no one was really talking about it. It was kind of a centerpiece of one of the presidential campaigns this year. But the idea of it is that every member of a community or a nation gets a certain amount of money each year from the government, paid out probably monthly, as a way to set a floor on people's incomes that. You know, it's not meant to, you know, end work or replace work or things like that. But, Andrew Yang, who ran for president, he proposed $1,000 a month that would go to every American. Ways to fund it and everything are also there, too. And I think it's rising in prominence right now and kind of fits into this specific context because, you know, there's just going to be a lot of economic dislocation that happens as a result of this. You know, like if you don't know when you're going to be going into quarantine, if you're going to be going into quarantine, we're encouraging folks to stay at home more. That's going to, you know, really has the potential to really impact things like the restaurant business and other service industries. And you know, in order to avoid a real economic, you know, a serious recession, we need to make sure that people still have financial resources so that they can buy things that they need and you know, sustain their families. And so I think whether it's, you know, at different times we've, you know, back in 2008, we sent a check to every American at one point to try to stimulate the economy. Things like that are going to probably be necessary at some level or another to kind of get us through this. Because aside from the whole public health piece of this, there's going to be a really serious economic crunch that it seems like is happening. We don't have good data on it yet, but finding ways to keep people, you know, financially above, you know, water is going to be really important for policymakers to grapple with.
The president is speaking, I think, at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Every time he has addressed the public about this, he has bungled something. And we've had to look for leadership away from the White House. That's just been the reality here. We need adults in charge. It has not come from the White House, and that's too bad. A couple of nights ago when he addressed the nation at 9 o'clock, he actually got facts wrong about a travel ban, about different policies, and immediately was contradicted by his own staff. So I'm hoping now what we'll see from the White House today is a little bit more of a coherent message on a plan. And by plan, I mean what they are calling the public to do to contain the virus, but also an economic plan, not just maybe we'll bail out the airline and the cruise industries, which is where things started, which is maybe where the mindset tends to be in this administration. But I have heard, Pete Nabosny, that the White House has been at least, there are people in circles close to the president leaning on a number of things, loan forgiveness, you know, different ways to immediately help not just the big industries, but individuals. I don't know what you're hearing. I mean, would you be surprised at this point? Nothing would surprise me anymore to put on the table, even for this White House.
Well, yeah, certainly, you know, nothing. Well, I think we are continually surprised by things, but we should try to get over that. No, I think that, you know, the president indicated at one point he wanted a full payroll tax holiday, which, you know, we've done that in the past. We've had payroll tax holidays, reduce payroll taxes at different times to sort of put more money into people's pockets from their paycheck. I think the challenge of this particular, you know, era that we're entering into is, you know, payroll tax holidays only benefit those people who are still working. And if there's a lot of people who are, their hours are cut or they're laid off during this stretch, particularly these heavily affected areas, you know, you're not going to get any benefit from that payroll tax holiday. So there are conversations around how do we sort of strengthen unemployment insurance. That's really important. You know, people, you know, are eligible to receive it. You extend the length of time they can get it. I think a key piece that I'm looking to see out of the federal government, and we can also talk about in some of the state context, is we're probably going to need to do things like waive requirements that you're seeking work and actively engaging in job seeking. If we're telling people to stay home and not and do the social distancing, going into, you know, 8 fast food restaurants to apply for a job, filling out the paperwork, meeting a manager, all those things is probably not what we want to be encouraging a ton of when we have these public health crises in different communities. So, you know, finding ways to tweak a lot of our public policies around assistance to people are really predicated on seeking work, engaging in job training programs, things like that. And it's probably time that we find some waivers on those things if we're trying to preserve the kind of public health good of this social distancing that we're encouraging people to do.
So if you are in the room, and I'll ask Julia this question as well, if you're in the room and they say, all right, you're going to get 3 things on your menu, you get whatever 3 things you want policy-wise, we'll do them, Pete.
So I would certainly say strengthen unemployment insurance so that so that people can, if as they're dislocated from work, they're still able to draw down some resources. I think we've got to do. I'm really concerned about the state of childcare, which we can get into later. As if childcare programs have to close, a lot of children who receive subsidized childcare, those programs don't get paid when the child's not in care. It's and so I'm worried about childcare workers and that whole kind of service area. So finding ways to keep these critical supports to families afloat so that they're there when we get out of this and they're not closed entirely. And then I think in terms of to extend some of our conversation about food, there's different proposals to really ramp up the amount of SNAP that people receive if people are out of work or they have their children at home. One option is going and getting food at a school that happens to be open, or they can do the pickup. But another option is ramping up the amount of SNAP that folks are eligible to get and kind of tweak those formulas so that they can go out and where they're able to get the food that they need to support their families at home. So unemployment insurance, finding ways to preserve some of these critical sectors that we have and really ramping up SNAP are kind of the three things I'm hoping to see out of this.
You didn't have UBI on there.
Well, I think that's another one. I don't think that we're not going to implement UBI as a core piece of this. I mean, there's other things I want to. I think paid sick leave would be a great benefit. I do think sending just cash assistance to people to both sustain the economy and to help folks afford their expenses. But you only gave me three, so I've got to set some priorities.
All right. We'll circle back because I want to talk paid sick leave a little bit more too. Julia, what's on your list if you're in there with policymakers?
Oh, I think Pete nailed it. Obviously, there's a long list of desires I'd have for our federal government right now, but I'm going to double down specifically on those measures that would increase access to food to people in need, specifically expanding SNAP benefits. And I believe there's a proposal before Congress right now to increase the value of SNAP benefits for those currently receiving it. We certainly support that. We know that SNAP is food stamps is one of the greatest anti-poverty programs our country has. It essentially puts dollars in people's pockets, and that has a ripple effect in the economy, which is also sorely needed right now. So I think that's the number one request that I would have is to expand SNAP. The great irony, of course, is that the Trump administration has repeatedly made attempts at cutting SNAP and has succeeded in one that continues to go through right now, even in the face of this public health crisis, and that is cutting off SNAP benefits to able-bodied adults without dependents. Pete talked about the work requirements that are there, so it changes the work requirement rule. We've been working with the county. We know that 5,000 people locally are being impacted by that and will continue to. And I would love to see at a federal level, at the very least, that they turn back that new legislation, which was already harmful, but now is obviously having a compounded issue in our community.
844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Julia Tedesco is president and CEO of FoodLink. Pete Nabosny is the policy director at the Children's Agenda. We're talking about the most vulnerable in our society, especially as we isolate and we try to follow the rules that they want us to follow, but we know that people are going to be hurting in a lot of different ways. So what do we do for each other? And what do we expect policymakers to do? After our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about paid leave. We're going to address whether the changes that might be made this year, whether it's UBI, paid leave, extension of benefits, as Pete and Julie have talked about, whether those ought to be a bridge to the post-corona period or if they ought to be made permanent. And I want to ask both of our guests, as we sort of assess all of these needs, what have we learned, and maybe Pete and Julia will say, we've been trying to tell you this for all along, but what do you think our society is learning about itself right now? Let's get that break and come right back with them on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about social isolation. We know that a lot of us have already changed our routines pretty dramatically when it comes to following guidelines for social distancing. Now, what does that mean, especially for those in nursing homes and those who might feel isolated to begin with, but really for everyone? How can we help each other? How can we lean on one another and think about each other's mental health? That's next hour. Welcome back. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. 844-295-TALK as we discuss those who are most vulnerable in our society dealing with changes to all of our lives during the time of increased risk to coronavirus. And we're all trying to sort of do social distancing. That will leave more of us isolated. Next hour, we're going to talk about the mental health impacts for all of us, especially for people who are elderly and people who might feel even more isolated in these times. But this hour, we're talking about what can tangibly be done to feed people, to get the help they need, to find the resources they need, to make sure they don't lose out on future opportunities if they're not applying for jobs at this time when they're told to stay home. So that's what we're talking about with Pete and Julia from the Children's Agenda and from Foodlink. And so, you know, Pete, we've referenced the writer Anand Giridharadas, who has been a strong commentator calling for sort of more progressive policies. And one of the things he's been railing on this week is we're going to have to see supports, social supports, in a lot of different levels. The question for us going forward when all of this finally clears out is, are we going to strip those supports away and say, well, that was temporary? And he's sort of urging us all to make the changes permanent, whatever comes. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I largely agree with him. I mean, we spoke about his book at one point, and I think he had a lot of great insight on a bunch of different issues. And one of those, one of his insights is sort of, you know, the role of philanthropy, which is, you know, it's supporting a lot of people versus how do we put, government policies in place to take care of some of these things. And I think I'll get exactly to your question today, but I think that we saw an example of it this week where, the NBA season was postponed indefinitely. Kevin Love, who's, a well-compensated NBA player for the Cleveland Cavaliers, he's donating $100,000 to help support the people who work at the Cavs arena in Cleveland there because they're losing paychecks and things like that and other Mark Cuban's been talking about that as well.
Cuban's been great.
Yeah, but and so those are good things, good steps that people can individually take, but it's hard to scale that up across the entire country by sort of acts of benevolence from different individuals. So having policies in place that kick in when whether it's a public health crisis or, an economic, recession or some kind of upheaval are really important. And so in some cases, this could be the event that gets us to think more seriously about things like paid sick leave across the country. And New York State, may pass it this year as part of the state budget, but there's a lot of other states in this country and a lot of folks who get sick all over and finding those supports for people is really important. If that comes out of this and we have a new reflection on the importance of giving people the ability to keep a paycheck even when they're sick, I think that'd be great. The big piece there's a deal kind of being worked out now, and we'll see what happens with that in D.C. But one thing that we can do to kind of give more certainty in the future on this is to set up what are called like automatic stabilizers. So you write laws that say if certain conditions occur and we know that we're falling into a recession or that there's some kind of serious economic disruption, different policies kind of kick into gear, whether it's the federal government share of Medicaid increases. States who have to manage their state budgets and balance them continually, they don't have a lot of room to find extra funds to handle an influx of new people on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Unemployment insurance, waiving some of those work requirements or extending the amount of time people can be on it in a recession. And if we have our laws set up in such a way that people know what will happen when some kind of downturn happens, it removes a lot of the uncertainty of how we're going to manage these crises and gives us a little bit more of a sense of how this is all going to play out, which is what reassures business, it reassures individuals, and people can kind of see that they're going to be taken care of one way or another when really bad things happen.
This morning before school, as my son often does, he's eating a bowl of fruit and watching SportsCenter, and he said, ESPN's boring now. Well, no sports. It's a time that I don't think anybody ever thought we would see. It's an extraordinary time. But he did notice the Kevin Love story, and I want to touch on one aspect of this a little bit more with Pete, because this is important. I love the Kevin Love story on its own as an act of individualism. $100,000 pledged to say, hey, if you worked at the arena, if you worked in the locker rooms, if you worked as support staff, all of a sudden your income is pulled out from under you, at least through April when the season was going to run. And I am going to step up and contribute to making sure you get those paychecks coming that you had planned on for the next few months. Then there was pressure on Cavs owner Dan Gilbert to do it. And at first he had done nothing. But after the outcry, he stepped up and said he would do something similar, which was great. I'm all for not shaming someone when they didn't do something fast enough. Just say, hey, you're on board. Good for you. Thanks for doing it. You mentioned Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, immediately stepping up saying the same. But you also, I think, bring it into the realm of making sure we don't overpraise acts of individual philanthropy, because when we do that, we sort of assume that that's the route to solving problems. And acts of philanthropy rarely solve structural problems. You see this in that category, it seems, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many other people who are, you know, it's really public, you know, the NBA season being canceled. And so maybe there's ways that certain individuals can step in on that. You know, the AHL season was just canceled. You know, we have people who work at the Blue Cross Arena that are facing a similar situation. There are people who, you know, as colleges have gone to remote learning, there are, you know, people who work at the restaurant across the street from a college, and they're going to be furloughed or laid. It's too hard to manage this through sort of good deeds alone. We need to have a set of policies and structures in place, because it's impossible to identify all those challenges in that way. So we need to think about how we organize our public assistance programs and our supports for workers who are dislocated and for families who are really faced with a lot of challenges right now. So that again, these things kick in, and we're not sort of relying on the good graces of individuals.
Sort of similar to my admonition earlier this week, saying, "Hey, if you're like me and you're not going out to restaurants anymore for a while, and you might not even go out to coffee shops anymore for a while. That's a hard one for me. Maybe buy some gift cards. Buy some gift certificates. Tell them I will be back. And I love you and support you. And I know this is going to be hard for you as a business owner. And I'm buying a gift card. And I'm going to use it on the other end of this. But I'm going to put some money up front." I love that idea. But again, can that be as effective as a policy remedy? Probably not.
It's just really difficult to scale that up at the levels that we need across the country and in our own community here.
Julia Tedesco, what changes that might happen this year based on this crisis could realistically be permanent? What do you think that could change that might actually allow us to say, hey, now we can do this better at least when the dust settles from all of this?
From an organizational perspective or government?
Yeah, I think from government policy, that whether it's funding, whether it's assistance for individuals, for organizations like Foodlink.
Yeah, well, I hope that this experience does shed light on the structural inequities that already exist. This isn't creating right now these disparities in wealth. It's just shining a light and exacerbating them. So many of the policies that Pete talked about, perhaps they'll have more support. At the organizational level, I think that it has continued to, number one, Foodlink prides itself on being as nimble and agile as possible. We were very quick to begin planning and to move into action and to cut our non-essential programs so that we could redirect all of our efforts and resources to feeding people. We fully acknowledge every single day that charity alone does not end hunger. It never will. It is always a public-private partnership. So we will do our piece as a nonprofit to get emergency food and to ramp up our stock. We plan to put about 3.5 million pounds of food into the community over the course of the next couple of weeks. But that is only effective if we also have governmental partners who can assist us, who can make sure that people are receiving benefits or receiving structural support for this. And I think a crisis like this has opened up doors for us to strengthen partnerships with the city of Rochester, who we already have a good relationship with, through the county, and certainly through the Rochester City School District. You know, again, I talked about yesterday, we sat down with school food officials there and talked about sharing labor and drivers and, different resources, which was somewhat unprecedented. So I hope those types of collaboration stick around after that. But Foodlink's going to continue to be responsive, as it always is in times of emergency.
Let me read a couple of emails directed at Foodlink with questions here. Very similar, so I'll read both of them. Jacob says, are there opportunities for those who have been told to stay home from work to help out with efforts surrounding COVID-19, like volunteering at FoodLink or testing centers? Or would such activities only risk additional social contact with the general population? That's Jacob. Here's Michelle. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I'm thinking about how I might be able to help support families who are in situations of food insecurity, especially if schools close, as they likely will. I noticed on the FoodLink website that many volunteer programs are suspended as part of social distancing. Bravo! But I imagine you will also need some help getting food to families. How can someone like me best help you support these families? Do you need volunteers to help deliver food? If yes, should we call or sign up online?
Yeah. I anticipated these inquiries, and I'm deeply appreciative for them. We did suspend our volunteer program. We host about 15,000 volunteers in our distribution center every single year. As you can imagine, there's large groups that come in. And so in an effort to protect our food supply under the guidance of Feeding America and other food banks that are experiencing this around the country, and to protect our workers, we did suspend large groups of volunteers right now. And that was met with love, anger, and frustration from our volunteers. And I applaud their commitment. So what we want to tell people right now is there may be opportunities, unique opportunities to volunteer as we progress in this in safe environments where risk is reduced and they can assist with distribution or packing. We would probably most likely be contacting volunteers on an individual basis so they can reach out to us via our website and let us know that they are available. But more than that, I'd like to encourage those volunteers to call 211 or to reach out to their local pantry. FoodLink is going to remain up and operating. It's the small pantries that are directly serving people in neighborhoods that have less resources, less volunteers, that are more likely to close this week, probably, because they don't have the resources to the manpower to stay open. So I would encourage volunteers to contact their local agencies and see what they can do to, number one, help them mitigate risk, help them clean, help them meet clients by appointment and rather than have large groups in there, and to continue to distribute, because agencies are going to have to think about distributing in innovative ways and different ways than they have in the past. So that's my advice right now. There's information on our website or call 211.
Okay. You want to add to that, Pete?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great that people are trying to find ways that they can be helpful during this, again, really uncertain time. We don't know what's going to happen in the next, days and weeks and months and all. And I think one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is if we get to a place where schools are closed and childcare programs are closed, those kids are still going to need to be cared for. Young children who, they can't be home alone and it's unsafe. And some of their parents will also be home because of what's going on and these efforts towards social distancing. But then a lot of parents, they won't be. There's people, particularly people who work in healthcare, which is a big industry, people like the folks working at FoodLink that have to get to work to help others and to help us manage this crisis. And I think that's where, within the context of we don't want, large groups gathering and we're encouraging social distancing, that's a place where, neighbors and communities can really support one another. And I think it is, I love to talk about the big public policy issues, but this is also a place where, civil society, people who know each other's situations can be really helpful for one another. Being able to take care of your neighbor's kids while they go work at a shift at a hospital is a really important thing that we need to be thinking about how we're supporting each other in this community. And so I'd encourage folks who are listening, who maybe have that flexibility, to think about the networks and circles around them and where they can be helpful to others, because we just don't know what's going to happen and we need to start thinking about some plans around that.
Yeah, I'll just add, we're particularly, as I already mentioned, concerned about seniors who are more likely to be living in isolation by themselves and be in frail health. And so there may be opportunities. I'm not aware of them yet, but as the county gears up to perhaps move to more of a home delivery model that is reliant on volunteers, there may be opportunities there. And there was a great article written by one of my role models. He is pretty well known, started DC Central Kitchen, LA Central Kitchen, Robert Egger, on the publication Civil Eats, about how this type of crisis calls for action in that respect too. What you were talking about, Pete, in maintaining a safe distance, keeping those risk reduction measures in place, but visiting neighbors and making sure they have enough food, particularly the seniors. So if people want to help, I would say definitely contact FoodLink, contact 211, but also look in your own neighborhood and how you might be able to reach out.
I do think this week has shown us that we are more capable of probably more capable of hard change than we think. And maybe it hasn't happened fast enough. And maybe there's been too much hesitation. But look at us now. Look at the end of this week versus how we started this week. We kind of started with some uncertainty. You know, the market was at 26K to start the week, or 25K. I mean, it was just remarkable. And people were talking about, well, maybe this or that. Now, almost nobody's out in public in a massive country. The schools are talking about closing down, you know, and people are about to be going through a lot of economic hurt, but they know it's the right thing to do for the moment. They are doing things that 3 days ago people said no one would do. All the sports seasons are stopped. I mean, it's just remarkable what has happened this week because of a collective decision to do what we know we must do. And that should offer hope here, because we've got to keep bending the curve. The curve, unfortunately, isn't going to be just this weekend or next week. It's going to be a long one, and we have to bend it for a while to have a chance not to have a medical system that feels overwhelmed. So be thinking about them. And I love Pete's idea of sort of thinking about who in your circle might be able to step in and babysit a child, or et cetera, because we're almost going to create our own little mini ecosystems for a while. This tight little circles you'll be in, that you'll mostly travel in those circles, you mostly won't go out to others, but you're going to lean on them, and that's really, really important. And I think Julia's point about the frailer, the more medically fragile among us, particularly seniors, we're going to talk more about that in our next hour. Peter in Rochester next. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that by coincidence, this coming week is the week for Scouting for Food, which is an annual food drive run by the local Boy Scout Council. We probably took this for granted in previous years, but this year it may be very important. And so starting this weekend, all next week and next weekend, there will be Scouts and Cub Scouts at all the Tops markets around our community, mm-hmm. collecting food for food pantries. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should make a real effort to see if we could help out with this.
Okay. Are you aware of that?
Yeah. Thank you for plugging that. It is always helpful when community members engage and raise food and funds. I have to say, we do have a fund on our website right now, an emergency response fund, and we can stretch food dollars. So we will take food that is gathered, but and we certainly, you know, it's a call out to all manufacturers. Cased product of food is really critical right now, because we are packing boxes to distribute, to have emergency food distributions throughout the community. So we're looking for that type of product. We're also looking for people to donate dollars, because we can stretch those food dollars and get as much into FoodLink as possible to prepare for this. If you go to foodlinkny.org, you can click on a button and donate. And I also just want to give a shout out to United Way of Greater Rochester, who has mobilized funders in the area and begun to respond, make a financial response to this need right now.
Evan, I'm writing to you as an anonymous local Girl Scout troop leader, and I'd like to shine a light on the situation many local troops and troop leaders find themselves in. In the midst of this pandemic, Girl Scout troops are still finding themselves with the need to host cookie booths outside of busy retail stores this weekend and throughout the month. The profits from the cookie sales help fund field trips and programming for the troop for the year, and so most troops order extra cookies specifically to sell at these booths. The troop is financially responsible for all of the cookies they order, and the payment is due at the end of March. This year, many families and troop leaders find themselves reluctant to host the booth sales due to coronavirus concerns, but the Girl Scouts of Western New York are not going to make changes to the cookie selling season or the payment deadline. Cookies not sold have to be covered by the troop, and most troops don't have the funds to cover it. It's a lot of unsold packages. Having time, more time to make the payment would give the option of selling more cookies to family, neighbors, friends, instead of encountering hundreds of people from the general public. And the Girl Scouts have said it's up to each troop's individual discretion as to whether or not to continue with the booth sales this weekend. That's from an anonymous person. I don't know. I haven't talked to the people in charge. Have you heard anything on that, Pete?
No, I haven't. And it seems like that, I mean, that can be a real challenge for, you know, families who had to, that are participating in this and have, you know, all those cookies and the costs associated with them and everything. And I think that's another place where we were talking earlier about the need for more flexibility in terms of how a lot of the policies that government sets, and waiving certain requirements and rules. And I think this is probably a good time for a lot of whether it's businesses or nonprofits or things like Girl Scouts of America to think about, well, what flexibility can they give to those folks that they're responsible for to extend the time on certain things. You know, I know a lot of employers are looking at, remote work options where previously they required people to always come in. I think all of us need to be thinking about where we can afford, flexibility as much as possible to help people, deal with what's going on right now, which is, again, as I said, at the beginning of the show, just a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and we want people to be cautious. And so wherever we can, apply those rules and give people that that flexibility.
So Girl Scouts, if the story I just read is incorrect, please get in touch with me, and I'm happy to correct the record there.
Can I correct real quick? I just got a text from my communications manager that scouting for food has been canceled as well, I'm sure for food safety reasons. So I will just go back to, if you want to support, or reach out to your local pantry to volunteer, or go onto our funding page at foodlinkny.org.
Foodlinkny.org. And I'm sure day by day there's a lot of sort of reexamination of what's happening. So we'll try to stay in touch that way. And again, Girl Scouts, I'll correct on your situation with the boots this weekend if I'm wrong. If that story's right, come on. Let's all do a little better. Let's be thoughtful here. 10 seconds, Pete Nabosny. What level of government is needed most to start solving some of these problems?
So I think everyone needs to do their part, but ultimately, in times of economic recession with balanced budget requirements, things like that, the federal government really needs to come through with a lot of policy changes, waivers, and particularly financial support to states and localities.
Are you an optimist, Julia, that you're going to have the support you need to keep doing what you need at Foodlink?
At the local level, absolutely. Our partners have mobilized, and we will get out food to people who need it.
Julia Tedesco, President and CEO of Foodlink, thank you for being here, for the mission, and for the continued work. Let's talk again.
Thank you.
Pete Nabosny, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. He has no choice but to talk again soon. We barely let him go.
Thanks for having me.
On a serious note, though, thanks. Thanks for the work you're doing, and thanks for the great insight during this time.
Thank you. Thanks.
More connections coming up.